Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have the privilege each week of tapping the intelligence of one of the most thoughtful, interesting, and courageous people I know in Washington, D.C. She is Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist and now blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, the author of two superb books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana, it's so good to have a chance to talk to you. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Frank. Wonderful to be with you.
I'm encouraged by what I heard from the president yesterday, and I want to take stock with you about it. At the United Nations, of course, he delivered a speech that was, I thought, in many respects, quite extraordinary, both for what it said and the fact that it was said to the people in that room. So talk a little bit about your thoughts on the subject.
Yes, well, absolutely. Well, just putting it into a little context, it wasn't so many years ago where we were talking about President Obama's speech to the United Nations in which he declared that the future will not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam. So we can see we've come 180 degrees five times from that particular point in American history.
Yeah, notably that radical Islamic terrorism is back as part of the presidential lexicon.
Well, it certainly was. And I would say that overall, and I think there's a lot to reflect on in the speech. It was very wide-ranging, and indeed, there's something for everyone, in a way, in the speech. For me, my ears perked up. I thought the phrase, the whole concept was marvelous when he said that the problem with Venezuela was not the poor implementation of socialism, but that it had been faithfully implemented. What we need to look at with the United Nations is it is a socialist assembly, and that includes, to a large degree, America in terms of the extent to which we have been, our government, our system has been socialized. I would say that on terms of not really going deep and thinking this through and understanding the history, I would say that President Trump's tough talk to the UN in terms of not being worth the money and the incredible expansion of staffing. I had no idea that the staffing had doubled since 2000. That's extraordinary. It's not about reforming the United Nations. I mean, the point is the United Nations has actually functioned beautifully as conceived by Alger Hiss, communist agent, American State Department official, in terms of creating and advancing the global agenda. So there's no concept of that, indeed, not just in President Trump and his speech writers, but also in the commentary around this. I mean, it's kind of like we're really walled off from the relevance of the moment and the concept and where he was, but he's trying.
And yet he did strike that tone of very direct criticism, both of the socialists and of the United Nations itself. And you were just going to where I wanted to talk next, Diana, if you could. Let's talk about sovereignty and the incredible importance that he clearly assigned to it in the speech. I lost track of how many times he referred to it, but it was clearly the leitmotif.
Yes, it is. It's a word, and it's something he's very attached to as a concept. And yet again, there's kind of a disconnect here, because when you have Elliot Abrams, for example, and Commentary Magazine extolling the substance of the speech as being something, I think Commentary said it was something, parts of it were things that Robert Kagan could have written. So in other words, there's sovereignty, but there's also the same concept of collective action, United Nations reform. In other words, there's great confusion in our land.
But you know, one of the things, Diana, I did think was striking about the reference to sovereignty, and let's be clear, folks, this is a shorthand in the classic Trumpian style for basically America.
American first, American, exceptionalism, all defined as our self-reliance and our necessary freedom of action as a sovereign nation. But he also talked about that as kind of the underpinning of a UN that might actually be worth a damn. That, you have sovereign nations, not some collective world government, but sovereign nations coming together to try to secure the peace or prevent terrible threats from eventuating and that sort of thing. That's how I heard it, Diana. Maybe I'm just reading too much into it from my own perspective, but talk through that if you would.
Well, I think that America first and American exceptionalism are actually different concepts. American exceptionalism is very often the banner under which America leads collective or not interventions. I mean, American exceptionalism, I think, is part of our rubric under which interventionism is very strong. America first, I think, is more about American core interests that do not need to be enmeshed in a global organization like the UN, regardless of the idea of sovereignty, regardless of the idea of any kind of restoration in the individual members. So I think there's just confusion here, and I don't believe the UN is in any way reformable. I don't believe that it's something the United States or President Trump should be trying to improve. I think that, going back to candidate Trump, there are things to improve about for our standing at home first and the world that are completely separate and irrelevant to the United Nations. So it's, again, going back to the sort of, I guess it's kind of, again, going something to everyone. We can all sort of see pieces of the speech that seem to speak to where we're all thinking, but I don't think there's anything cogent here, and that could be part of the way, a speech like that is made. On the other hand, there are great moments in the speech. It's refreshing. There are certain aspects of the speech, but I think that it's there's a lot of thinking that needs to be done. And again, it's, as you alluded to at the very beginning, it's rhetoric.
That's the key point. I did want to just talk to you about that particular piece of the larger trajectory of the Trump presidency at the moment. When we visited last week, we were both, I think, very much in the mode that the president has lost his way. Now the rhetoric is back, it seems, bracing in some respects at least, and I think hopefully illustrative of where the president would like to go once again, more or less along the lines of what he campaigned on. But Diana, there are two pieces of this that it seems to me will really define whether this is a brave new Trump presidency or it's going to be afflicted with the same sorts of internal and dysfunctional qualities that we've seen to date. Namely, will the president's top subordinates publicly undermine him in the kinds of comments and direction that he's given? And two, will there be any backup to it, indeed, not just at the rhetorical level? Your thoughts on those two points?
Well, I'm pessimistic at this point. I can be, have my mind changed by evidence and by watching things as they develop. But no, I don't have very strong confidence in that at this point. We shall see. And I would say that the place where the presidency of Donald Trump will stand or fall is much more at home than abroad. We are on fire at home, whether it's free speech, as you and I have discussed for many years, we're under such assault at home at this point, whether it's the surveillance state, the Stasi-like surveillance state, which we are now finding out. We had President Obama's administration surveilling the opposition party, the Trump campaign. We're getting more and more details. I want more and more details. It's an outrageous situation. We have a Justice Department that is either A, allowing a special counsel to run amok, and B, not doing anything that we expected in the restoration of law and order, the border, the wall, Mexico, drugs. I mean, these are the things that Trump connected with the people on, and it was much more about standing back to an extent on the world stage in terms of not continuing the useless, wasteful interventions in a place like Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., and taking care of the America first home. So this is kind of where I think it will rise or fall. And I think rhetoric to the world is great. It may only be somewhat entertaining.
We'll see indeed. Diana West, we have to leave it at that. Ken Timmerman joins us next. We'll talk with him about the speech and specifically what the president said about Iran and where we go from here. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Ken Timmerman, a Renaissance man, an investigative reporter of great renown, a man who has authored numerous books, both fiction and nonfiction, including most recently Deception, the making of the YouTube video Hillary and Obama blamed for Benghazi. He's also been very active for a long time as a freedom fighter, notably as the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. His work in that regard earned him a nomination for a Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 as he strove to expose and shut down Iran's nuclear weapons program, which has unfortunately only become more imminent in the intervening years. Ken Timmerman, I'm so glad to have you back with us. Thank you. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Frank. Thanks for having me on.
Well, first of all, we were just talking with Diana West about her take on the UN address the president made yesterday. I'd like very quickly to get yours.
Well, I agree with what Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel said. It was a bold speech. It was a clear speech. And it was a very necessary speech, putting the world community and the United Nations on notice that the United States was going to finally act in its own interest and hopefully find common interest with other countries.
I think Netanyahu used some formulation like it was the most extraordinary speech he'd heard of that kind in the United Nations in some 30 years. Yeah, and I tend to agree. Ken, of course, one of the key pieces of that speech was the president calling out the various threats to international peace that the UN is supposed to be trying to safeguard. Prominent among them, and it came in for a very sustained denunciation, was, of course, the mullahocracy of Iran. You've spent a lot of time, both in the region and from over on this side of the pond, warning about trying to help the rest of us understand the threat emanating from that country. Ken, I wanted to get your take on what the president said about Iran in his remarks to the United Nations.
Well, I was heartened by what President Trump said. I think it's the first time since George W. Bush in 2003. President Trump clearly dissociated the Iranian regime, the clerical regime, from the Iranian people, just the opposite of what Obama had done. And he said the first thing the Iranian regime needs to do is to set its people free. They are oppressing their own people. They're using their money to support Hezbollah, to spread terrorism around the world instead of bettering the lot of their own people. I think it was an extraordinarily important thing to say. It was an important thing for the U.S. president to say.
Well, I want to talk to you about the policy business. One of the things that we had coming out of those remarks, of course, was a reiteration of the kind of condemnation of the JCPOA, as it's called formally. I think of it as the Obama bomb deal. When you heard what he said about that, Ken, did you come away with the sense that he is going to renounce it, that it's over? And if so, what do you expect will come of the conversations that Rex Tillerson is having with the Iranians and the other parties to that joint agreement?
Far be it for me to read what's in President Trump's mind. He has a way of surprising us all, but it sure sounded like he was saying the deal with Iran was over and that Tillerson was going to inform the Iranians that they had to make very, very serious changes to the deal, and notably the sunset provisions that allow them to do whatever they want in the nuclear arena after 8 to 10 years. And the Iranians have made clear that they are not open at all to any kind of changes to this deal because they got the best deal they could possibly hope for. Every time they were negotiated with John Kerry, and Kerry said, "Well, isn't this what you want?" And they would say, "No, no, no, we want more." And Kerry continuously gave them more.
Ken, I remember vividly the European saying privately that Kerry was acting as the Iranian's lawyer, trying always to represent his client, which is not how that was supposed to work. But you're right, and I think President Trump was right in calling it an embarrassment to the United States that this kind of deal went down under President Obama and John Kerry's watch. Let me ask you, as we talk about this Tillerson meeting with the so-called permanent five plus one, that is to say the UN Security Council plus the Germans, and the Iranian foreign minister today, we're having the conversation before that meeting is concluded. This program will air afterwards. One of my concerns is that Rex Tillerson has not consistently, faithfully elaborated on and helped translate into action the president's policies as he has announced them. Should we be concerned that that may be the upshot of this conversation today?
Look, I'm looking at this from the outside, but frankly, if Rex Tillerson backs away from that, from the president's very, very strong criticism of the Iran deal, saying it was the worst deal ever negotiated, if he backs away even one iota, I would imagine that his tenure as Secretary of State would be in jeopardy. And if not, it should be.
Well, let's hope. We've watched Tillerson and others, notably H.R. McMaster at the National Security Council, inserting wiggle room where there shouldn't be any. Hey, Ken, let me turn to a different topic, not unrelated, of course, but still in the Middle East, though. It involves a referendum coming up this weekend, as I understand it, or early next week, in the Kurdish part of Iraq. I know you've been there recently. You've reported about what the Kurds are up to and what they aspire to and why we should be supporting them. I was rather surprised, though, to see you recently announcing that you thought it's time to take the group known as the PKK, a group the United States government has long considered to be a terrorist organization, as has the government of Turkey, against which the PKK has operated for a long time, off the list of terrorist organizations. Talk about both of these issues, the Kurdish referendum, if you would, their aspirations, and where the PKK fits into all of that.
Well, the Kurds in northern Iraq are want to lay down a marker, first of all, vis-a-vis the Iraqi government, which is welched on every agreement it's ever made with them, and which today is dominated by the Iranian regime, but also to Kurds in Turkey, in Syria, and in Iran, that they too can aspire to independence. They would like to see a greater Kurdistan. That's not in the cards today. Possibly not tomorrow, but the day after, it certainly could be in the cards. As to the PKK, you know, Frank, for years I have resisted any kind of association. I haven't met with the PKK. I have agreed or thought I agreed with Turkey's denunciation of them as a terrorist group. And recently I've had opportunities to meet with their people in northern Iraq and elsewhere. And they provided me with new information that changed my view. So has the behavior of Erdogan changed my opinion. Number one, they provided me with compelling information that a lot of the so-called terrorist attacks inside Turkey were actually not carried out by the PKK, but by provocateurs, you know, groups that had been put up to it by Turkish intelligence. Even the Belgian appeals court, and my article was pegged to an appeals court decision that found that the PKK was not a terrorist group, but a party to an armed conflict with the government of Turkey. Even they found that these were done by provocative agents working for the Turks. So the PKK is not carrying out terrorist attacks inside Turkey. They are in a military struggle. And then Erdogan is an Islamist dictator. He is not behaving in the interest of the United States. He's attacking our allies, our Kurdish allies in Syria with his military forces. I think it's time to put Erdogan on notice that he can't just get away with suppressing the rights of a very, very large portion of the Turkish population.
Ken Timmerman, your study of these subjects and your thoughtful and clarifying insights into them and what we should be doing about them is really appreciated. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Joe DeGeneva about the latest revelations of the Obama administration's abuse of our national security capabilities for political warfare against President Trump's campaign. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is our distinct pleasure and high honor to have with us a man I've come to admire greatly for his service to our country in a number of different capacities, including now in the private sector as a commentator and analyst of matters involving the law. But in a previous life, he helped enforce it as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. He was an independent counsel, a counsel on Capitol Hill in several different inquiries. He is, of course, best known perhaps, though, for the work that he's doing at the moment at the law firm of DeGeneva and Tensing as a lawyer as well as a commentator on programs like ours. It's always great to have with us Joe DeGeneva. Joe, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Nice to be with you, Frank.
So I'm struck by some of the things you've been warning of for some time, Joe, the increasing evidence now that the Obama administration was using a whole variety of instruments of the state in the furtherance of what amounts to, it seems, political warfare against Donald Trump and his presidential candidacy. Is that reading too much into what we know so far?
Well, I don't think it is reading too much into it. First of all, we begin... Let's think about how all of this probably got started. You've seen recently the unmasking issue has taken on new life. Susan Rice's testimony before various committees has come out that she is now admitting that she lied publicly when she said she knew nothing about unmasking and revealing the names of American citizens in foreign intelligence surveillance tap. She is a serial liar. It has become part of the public policy of the Obama administration to use lying as a tool of public policy. What we have in her case, however, is we now know, and I reported this months and months ago, that the National Security Council staff, under Susan Rice's directive as the National Security Advisor, and in her orders to Ben Rhodes and John Brennan to produce evidence of American citizens on foreign intelligence wiretaps. They did that, and in the course of getting information about Americans inadvertently as a result of foreign surveillance taps on ambassadors and other foreign countries, they produced dozens of spreadsheets of the names of those individuals and presented them in the White House proper to President Obama, Susan Rice, Ben Rhodes, and John Brennan. And Brennan, through the NSA, got the spreadsheets of these intercepts. It is now clear that that was the basis for getting Manafort into the system, getting FISAs on other people, including him, for a time, which then led ultimately to the criminal investigation of him. It sets up the interesting question about who else was on the list of Americans who were intercepted. And it's pretty clear it was all of the Trump campaign people, members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats and others. I remember back when I first reported this months ago that Rachel Maddow spent 15 minutes accusing me of being un-American for saying that Susan Rice was lying. I haven't gotten my apology yet from Rachel Maddow. I'm sure she'll have amnesia about how she defended Susan Rice, but make no mistake about it.
Let me just drill down on this for one moment because I want to make sure I'm clear and the audience as well. When you talk about what sounds as though it was kind of the incidental sweeping up of people who just happened to be working for the Trump campaign because they were monitoring foreign ambassadors and the like, is it not the case that we actually have reason to believe they were purposely targeting people, whether it was Paul Manafort or others on the campaign? It wasn't just an accident that they happened to get them in this dragnet.
Yes, it started out as incidental, and then it became targeted, giving the names of those people to the NSA to produce documents on. This is actually, you know, where the rubber meets the road. No, you're absolutely right. It became targeted surveillance of political opponents. In the case of Manafort, because of his years of doing political consulting in Eastern Europe and elsewhere, he obviously inevitably would come up in conversations with Ukrainian officials, Crimean officials, and Russian officials. That's probably how he got started down this road and how he became the focus. And he may even have been the subject of a Title III criminal wiretap, although we do not know that. We do know that his home was raided, which requires a search warrant, which requires probable cause of a crime. So I think Manafort's in deep trouble. It doesn't mean that anybody else is, but certainly there's no evidence that President Trump is in any trouble whatsoever.
And would you, just to distill the public policy implications of this, Joe DeGeneva, to the extent that what we are now examining is an abuse of the authorities of the president, the abuse of and abuse of intelligence collection, the use and abuse of the deep state, if you will, certainly the National Security Council for nakedly political purposes, what should that mean for the investigations that have been spawned by all of this? Should they be brought to a close? Can they be brought to a close? Or will they go on as though this is of no consequence at all?
Well, it'll probably be the latter. They will continue because once there's a predicate established that something is amiss, as there clearly has been in the case of Paul Manafort, nothing is going to stop Mueller's investigation. People who think that's the case are really whistling Dixie. In addition, I was somewhat perplexed by comments by Trey Gowdy within the last 7 days when he was asked about Susan Rice's testimony, and he appeared to say that she had acted appropriately. I've never heard him explain what he meant by that or what it is that he heard in these various hearings that made him think that everything she did was kosher. I don't know if he was talking merely about one item or two items, but clearly the sweeping directive that she gave Brennan to seize information about dozens of people, which led to dozens of spreadsheets of intercepted communications being presented to her, Ben Rhodes, John Brennan, and the president. I don't believe his answer is satisfactory, and I think it requires some exposition. But make no mistake about it, the Manafort matter is now a serious criminal investigation. It's going forward. Nothing is going to stop that case. Whether or not this has any implication for anybody else in the Trump campaign or any of the nonsense about Russian collusion, of which there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever, is hard to say. But clearly they're going after Manafort in an effort to get him to, quote-unquote, cooperate. He may have nothing to cooperate about, for all we know, and apparently he doesn't.
Well, we'll see. When they start squeezing him, who knows what will come out. Let me ask you, Joe, we're having this conversation in the course of congressional consideration of renewal of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, what your recommendations as a longtime denizen of the staff up on Capitol Hill, as well as a former U.S. attorney and special counsel yourself. How would you recommend the Congress proceed, given the abuses that are now evident? Should that law be scotched or substantially rewritten?
I think it should be rewritten, and I think there should be new requirements for the production of data upon request to Congress. Congress has, as usual, done a very poor job of oversight here, and only in the waning hours when it becomes obvious that something was amiss does it finally begin to look into things. I have very little confidence in congressional oversight, especially in the hands of Republicans who have shown themselves to be inept at oversight, but here's what we need to do. In exchange for extending the ability to do mega data collection and then eventually analysis based on court authorization, the Congress should require immediate disclosure of all unmasking that went on during the entire Obama administration, the names of all people who were tapped, where the information went, who saw it, and they should require a federal criminal investigation of the leaks that occurred as a result of President Obama extending the number of people who got access to the unmasking information. It is quite obvious that President Obama was trying to make it easier for people to leak information about the Trump campaign and related Trump people. So I think before I would reauthorize, I would demand certain things from Jeff Sessions.
Very interesting, and I hope that these kinds of recommendations will be taken to heart, because you're absolutely right. The Congress has not shown itself terribly well-equipped to handle the oversight, let alone the accountability that's needed. Keep up the good work, my friend. Joe DeGeneva, it's so good to talk with you. Let's do it again soon. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Baroness Carolyn Cox, an extraordinary freedom fighter in the United Kingdom, about what's happening in her country.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's a great pleasure to say we're back, joined by Baroness Carolyn Cox, one of the most remarkable and extraordinarily courageous people I have ever met. She is these days a member of the British House of Lords, but she has really become an international, well, rock star, I guess I'd say, in terms of her commitment to freedom and people who are desperate to enjoy it and who are at risk of either never experiencing it or losing it. And that would unfortunately include some of her own people in the United Kingdom now being relentlessly attacked by jihadists, Sharia supremacists, if you will. To talk about all of that and what it in fact, unfortunately, probably portends for us, if we're not careful, I'm very pleased to welcome back Baroness Carolyn Cox. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us, ma'am.
Well, thank you very much, Frank, and thank you for your very kind words. I don't recognize myself in all your compliments, but it's a privilege to be speaking with you about things we both care about.
Indeed. Let's talk quickly about the attacks. There have been at least five of these jihadist incidents in the United Kingdom just in this year, including one that could have gone frightfully badly. Fortunately, it was just one that injured a bunch of people. But what is going on, Baroness, and what does it suggest about the larger state of affairs in your country?
Thank you. Yes, indeed, there have been five terrorist attacks this year. I was actually in Parliament when the one was carried out on Westminster Bridge and on the precincts of Parliament itself, when someone ran their vehicle mowing down pedestrians on the bridge, and then a policeman was actually stabbed to death at the precincts of the gates to the House of Commons. And we were knocked down there for several hours because there was fear that there could be further attacks. Not on that occasion, but there have been attacks since then. A Manchester attack was a horrendous one in which children died. And then the most recent one in Parsons Green Station, that's on our metro network. And very fortunately, the particular device did not go off as intended. It partially went off, and there was a kind of ball of fire that did injure a number of people, I think about 30 with burns. But if the whole thing had gone off, I understand there were nails inside it and other pieces of devices intended to cause maximum harm, injury, and indeed death. And I think if the whole thing had gone off, it could have been a number of serious number of deaths as well as horrendous injuries.
What does this portend for the United Kingdom? Is there evidence that this is sort of a growing insurgency and is yet to be understood as such and responded to? And if so, what does the future hold for Britain as you see it, Baroness Cox?
Well, I think we can see it as part of a much larger strategy. So-called Islamic State claims responsibility, or it may say credit, for these horrific activities. If that is the case, then clearly it is part of a much more global movement in which many of the people who have been apprehended or who have committed suicide in undertaking these horrific attacks have done so for ideological reasons. I think sometimes they're quite explicitly Islamist in their ideology and in their justifications for what they're doing. And clearly that is a much larger picture. What's currently going on in Britain at the moment is an intensive search by the police for people who may be associated with the Parsons Green attack, suggesting it wasn't just a lone wolf attack, but maybe part of a bigger network. And indeed, some arrests have been taking place, suggesting that it was part of a bigger network.
And that's really what I wanted to get at, as I know you have been warning of in Parliament for years, is the problem that the infrastructure that has been put into place and the use that is being made of it, sometimes I think we mistake it for innocent simply because it's kind of pre-violent, but it is leading, is it not, to the kinds of violence that you've been seeing. And to the extent that there's what the Muslim Brotherhood calls a sort of civilization jihad as a precursor to the more horrific kind that you've been experiencing of late, is the government of Britain at this point properly gripped with what's the sort of precursor and taking steps to correct that?
Certainly, I think that there is beginning to be an awareness that this is part of that much bigger picture. We have witnessed that bigger picture in countries such as Nigeria and Sudan. I've been there when in places where these horrendous terrorist activities and movements are taking place. It's been reported this morning that Theresa May, our Prime Minister, is showing some concern for the use of social media to inculcate ideological commitment in ordinary citizens. I think it's been suggested in the past that people in the UK have actually been converted to this very radical, fundamentalist, extremist Islamism through the social media.
But could I just stop you on this point? Because what I'm struck by, and it's not unique to Britain, I hear it in European capitals and, for that matter, here in the United States as well, much talk about this proselytizing and inculcating of Sharia supremacism, if you will, through the internet, but there's scarcely ever a conversation about what's being done in these mosques that have been built by the Muslim Brotherhood with Saudi funding and perhaps the Turks or the Qataris or otherwise. Are we missing that element? And if so, what are the consequences?
Well, I think there is a very serious issue here. When we were in Syria and we spoke to the Grand Mufti, he was very concerned that when he'd visited Britain, the mosques which he attended, he said the imams were very radicalized, probably Wahhabi, that's a kind of Saudi Arabian ideology, and maybe funded by Saudi Arabia. And he said, it was his suggestion, that you ought to have a training center for imams who would bring up imams with values compatible with democracy and freedom. You know, people abroad can see what's happening in this country and are deeply worried about it. And I think, you know, we need to raise awareness and deal with this seriously.
Well, and lastly, let me just ask you, because this is really the crux of the matter as far as I'm concerned. We're watching one of the countries arguably that we are closest to in the world experiencing what is clearly intended for us as well. If you had a moment with President Trump and had an opportunity to talk with him about the insights from your collective experience now, what would your recommendation be to him to prevent a similar kind of horror from being inflicted against the United States?
Well, I think we have to be highly security conscious. We have to make sure we're not in any kind of appeasement mode, which would be preventing the necessary actions being taken. I'm afraid of upsetting cultural sensitivities. It's been one of the problems in this country that there has, in the past, certainly been cases where, in the area which I work in particularly, which is the problem of Muslim women suffering from the application of Sharia law in ways which deprive them of a decent life, you know, the asymmetrical divorce, a man should divorce you three times, the condoning of domestic violence and domestic abuse, and sometimes when they've gone to the police have not come to support them because they're afraid of upsetting cultural sensitivities. We've got to realize we've got a political, cultural, and spiritual heritage we have to pass on undiminished to the next generation. And we have to protect that, whatever it takes. in terms of our own values, respecting, obviously, human rights, but not appeasing and allowing these things to happen which are incompatible with our political, cultural, and spiritual heritage. And so I've got a lot of support from Muslim women, you know, on this. So we have to work with those Muslims who are willing to speak up and speak out. And from my point of view, Muslim women who are suffering, some of them are some of the bravest in speaking out.
Indeed. Well, right up there with you. Baroness Carolyn Cox of the United Kingdom, thank you so much for your time. Your inspiring and courageous leadership. I have both sides of the pond. We hope to talk with you again very soon. I hope to talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.